Good evening and welcome to Radio Edutalk. This is David Noble and Dalgetty Bay in a glorious spring evening. And delighted to welcome to the show this evening Professor Clive Dimmock of the Robert Owen Centre for Educational Change. Welcome to Radio Edutalk, Clive.
Thank you, David.
And over the next 20 minutes or so, we're going to be hearing a little bit about your kind of recent work and something I think you're actually going to be presenting at an event at the University of Edinburgh soon. And we're kind of talking around, it's quite a long title, but Leadership for Powerful Learning in Primary and Early Years, 10 Strong Claims for High-Performing Leaders and Schools. And just before we hear from Professor Dimmock, I'll just say at this point, if you're listening to the live show, you can get in touch in two ways. You can email edutalker, that's edutalkr, at hotmail.co.uk, or you can pop something up and include the hashtag edutalk. So, Clive, if you don't mind, could you give us a kind of brief background to your work in academia and in education?
Certainly, yes. I've been in university world supervising, teaching and training leaders for quite a few decades now, more than I care to mention. But my main focus is on leadership for school improvement, leadership that builds capacity in schools, that ends up at improving the student learning for all achievement levels, from high achievers to low achievers, which is what obviously we're all about, really.
And can you tell us about the work of the Robert Owen Centre for Educational Change? Certainly, my kind of background understanding is it's kind of tied in with the sort of reason attainment agenda and narrowing the gap. Would that be right?
Yes, very much so. The centre was set up 2 or 3 years ago in the University of Glasgow School of Education. Professor Chris Chapman is leading it. Its mission is really not just to serve the educational community, professional community in Scotland, but internationally. And the main agenda items are, as you indicate, to promote educational change for improvement and with a very strong social justice agenda.
And your work around these the 10 strong claims for high-performing leaders in schools, am I right in saying, Clive, that this is something that you've kind of developed over the last few years? I mean, I think I saw a presentation in Australia a few years ago where, you know, at the time it was 5 strong claims. So is this a kind of
You're absolutely right, David. Yeah, over the last few years, it started off with 5 with a keynote in Australia. That sort of motivated me to delve further into the research archives and so forth, and it's now grown to 10.
Brilliant. And is this, forgive me, I'm a long kind of long time away from my own doctoral studies, but is this a meta-analysis, or are you looking at research across the world? What kind of...
Sure. Yeah. Well, it's international. Mm-hmm. That is to say that the source of the data is international. It's largely American, Australian, North American, I should say, Australian and UK-based. But it's also actually, interestingly, a combination not just of academic research, such as done in universities by people like myself, my colleagues, but it's also based on a lot of professional professional development around the world, and feedback from, if you like, the coalface, from practitioner principals, and very much also inclusive of their what we call tacit knowledge, which is the knowledge that they've gained from on-the-job experience. So it's really 10 claims, strong claims, that I feel bold enough to put forward based on those divergent sources of evidence.
And I wonder if at this point, Clive, whether you would mind, by all means, you know, we could race through all 10 strong claims, or if you maybe want to pick out the kind of main ones. I mean, certainly from my own kind of background reading, it seems as if it's all about the importance of the the high school principal or the school leader, and also the working in kind of unconventional ways. So, you know, kind of modelling good professional learning oneself, and looking again at professional learning communities. And I know the literature has been around for a while on that. So, you know, feel free just now, Clive, to kind of take us through some of the claims.
Sure. Well, the first point to make is that people say, you know, there's a shortage of leaders in education, and in one way, they're right. But I prefer to put it like this, that the real grave shortage is across all systems, not just Scotland, but internationally, is a shortage of what I call high-performing leaders. You know, we've got enough poor and mediocre-performing leaders. And what we need is a whole generation, a whole cadre of high-performing leaders, which, to be fair, is one of the missions of SCEL, the Scottish College of Education Leadership under Gillian Hamilton. So that's a very strong mission that SCEL has both now and into the future to, as it were, generate more high-performing leaders in the Scottish school system. So, yes, well, if you'll allow me, what I'd like to do is just skim over the 10 claims, and then we can pick out one or two or a few of them if you prefer to come back to. So the first claim is that high-performing leaders possess certain personal qualities or attributes or dispositions that give them what we call higher-order abilities. And this raises their performance as leaders above the mediocre or the poor leaders. And we can come back to those, but they include things like ability to read situations, to make balanced judgments, to have strong values and so forth, and to call on those at various points in their decision making. So the first claim is that high-performing leaders possess certain qualities and attributes and dispositions that give them higher-order abilities. The second one is, as you indicated earlier, the ability to transform their schools into professional learning communities. The OECD work that I did coined the lovely phrase, schools as innovative learning environments. And I suppose if I had to sum up all that I'm saying tonight, it is that high-performing leaders have the ability to transform their schools into 21st century innovative learning environments. And professional learning communities are at the heart of that. A third point, a strong claim, is very much related to the previous one of creating schools as professional learning communities. It's that these high-performing leaders have a real emphasis on insisting, really, that their staff, their teachers, are research-engaged. So they adopt research-engaged practices. And the professional development that takes place in their schools is very much centred on the school's needs, individual school's needs, and based around teachers grounding their practice more in informed or evidence-based research practices. The fourth claim is that there's a strong focus by such leaders on promoting teaching practices with particularly high effect sizes on student learning. You know, in other words, some teaching practices have been shown to have a high impact on student learning. And these high-performing leaders are aware of such practices, and of course they endorse and encourage their teachers to adopt them. The fifth one, the fifth claim, strong claim for high-performance leaders, is that they really, really care about teachers. They're very focused on engaging teachers and on gaining teacher engagement and commitment to the school that they're teaching in, and they go out of their way to motivate teachers. Easier said than done, but I differentiate this from the almost obsessive focus over the last 10, 15 years on student outcomes, because I think these leaders realize that if you get committed and engaged teachers, that's the way in turn to obtain improved student learning outcomes. So they don't just focus on the outcomes, but they focus on teachers and teaching as the processes by which to achieve student outcomes. The sixth one is the adoption of what I call sensible, viable patterns of engaging teachers in leadership. In other words, thoughtful, high-performing leaders will take into account the present situations in their schools and put into place a deliberate, conscious policy of expanding. I don't like the word distributed because I think it's got wrong connotations, but that's often used, the term distributed leadership. I think it's a bit of a misnomer. I prefer expansive or shared leadership, but they don't do that overnight. They realize they can't suddenly swing from a monopoly of power, if you like, in the principal's position to the other extreme position of sharing leadership across the teaching force. But that's what they're trying to aim for in the medium and long term. And how fast they do it and how they do it will depend on each school's particular situation. The seventh strong claim is that these leaders, high-performing leaders, are passionate about redesigning and transforming their schools to be fit for purpose. And so they realize that you can't just achieve school improvement year in and year out by tinkering piecemeal with new teaching methods here or new teaching methods there. But they realize that teaching and learning, which is the focal and most important part of schools, is supported in turn by a whole host of design features in schools, such as the timetable, the structuring of student groups, student learning, structuring of teachers, the allocation of resources, the application of technology, the building of perhaps a new school culture to support it all, and finally their own leadership style, which is crucially important in making all these parts of the jigsaw that make up a school fit together. So you get a synergistic effect at the end. 2 + 2 = 5 when you've got all these supporting structures and processes supporting new pedagogy and new learning. The eighth and ninth are really what I call engineering inclusive school communities driven by social justice agendas. So they include things like being a culturally sensitive leader, being aware of the ethnic and cultural differences between minority ethnic groups and mainstream groups, and having a real passion to maximize the talents of all students and teachers in the school, no matter how diverse the ability range of the school or the ethnic composition of the school. And finally, the 10th strong claim is that because we're trying to generate more and more high-performing leaders across the system, such as in Scotland, it's really, really important to emphasize that where we do find talented, high-performing leaders, that we work with them, we develop them, we train them, we resource them and support them to become what we call system leaders, so that they can work beyond their own schools, in other schools with other leaders, and provide mentoring and, if you like, they demonstrate and model and advise other schools as to what high-performing leaders and schools hoping to become 21st century innovative learning environments look like. So sorry to go have gone on a bit long there, but those are the 10 strong claims.
That's fantastic, Clive. And I'll just say again that any listeners listening to live show, you can get in touch by email or Twitter if you've got any comments or questions for Clive based on what you've heard over the last few moments. And Clive, I mentioned to you before the show, we got some questions in beforehand, and Gillian Hamilton of Skell actually has a question about system leadership within Scotland. She says, you talk often about system leadership in Scotland, and do you think at present we actually do we have at this moment in time a shared understanding of what we actually mean by system leadership?
No, I don't think we do. I mean, the system leadership, and that's not to be too critical of Scottish education. I think that's the state of play in many other systems too, in those advanced education systems across the world. I mean, the whole concept of system leadership, as I understand it, isn't that old. I mean, you go back to 208, not much beyond 208 to see the seeds of the ideas of system leadership beginning to form, and a few writers beginning to share ideas about system leadership. So really, it's only in the last 8 years or so that the whole concept has come about. And it's still, as Gillian's question rightly, I think, sort of indicates, it's still a concept in formation. And that's what makes it exciting. For me, my thinking about system leadership is that, you know, it's the basic core of it is encouraging leaders who are already showing high potential as leaders, who've got demonstrated track records of leading their schools through an improvement process, a sustainable improvement process over a number of years, allowing there or encouraging them as a leadership resource to share their expertise, experience and achievements with other schools for the benefit of more students across the system. Now, that's all very well and good, and it can take various forms. For example, there's the idea of heads mentoring other heads, heads of good schools partnering schools with lower performance levels, heads forming school improvement partnerships with, say, half a dozen schools. And the idea there is that they all share resources and motivate and encourage all the schools in the group towards improvement targets, and so on and so forth. There's probably another two or three ideas for system leadership beyond those that I've mentioned. But just recently, I've been thinking that you need that sort of an idea, it's almost an empty shell in itself, the idea of system leadership. What, of course, you need is the substance grafted onto that shell. So, for example, if you're advocating heads going beyond their own schools to work with other heads of one or more other schools, then you want to guarantee that those heads have some substantive expert knowledge in, for example, learning-centered leadership, so that they have some substance to share, some expert knowledge of pedagogy, of learning theories, of learning application in different school contexts, so that they've got something substantive to share when they engage with those other heads and those other schools. And the same with social justice and equity. We still have a long way to go in terms of identifying key practices that leaders, successful leaders of equitable schools, can share with other leaders who are trying to improve their equity records in their schools. So it's about grafting onto the notion, the shell concept of system leadership, I believe it's now a question of grafting onto that shell substantive ideas of leadership in areas like learning-centered leadership or instructional leadership, as the North Americans call it. Good practices of achieving more equitable schools, closing the gaps between low achievers and high achievers, middle achievers, and so on. So that's where my work in particular is going at the moment. And through Julian and Skell's auspices, I hope to be doing that in the forthcoming months on the fellowship course.
And when you mention, Clive, when you mention learning-centred leadership, that's the whole notion that it's all about teachers and teaching and the curriculum and teaching quality, and everything else is kind of secondary to that.
Yes, absolutely. I think whenever I bring this strong claim up, I get a resounding sort of sense of support and enthusiasm and passion from the teachers or principals in the audience. And it's just so natural a response, isn't it? It's surprising that we even have to mention it, really, that, you know, the key to good schools, the key to good student learning is quality teaching, as you rightly say, David. And that in turn begs the question, well, what do good high-performing principals need to do? Well, they obviously need to do everything within their power to support, encourage and promote good quality teaching in their schools. Now, what that comes back to is a sense of really principals demonstrating real care. So they really care about their teachers individually and collectively, that they're prepared to go the extra miles to support them, nurture them, understand their problems, either professional, personal problems that come up from time to time. They're prepared to do everything possible to nurture and develop those teachers and meet their needs. And it's that sort of motivation. And individual teachers motivated by different things. So at the end of the day, it's do principals really take the time out? Do high-performing leaders really, if they're going to be high-performing, take the time out to really understand what motivates the individual teachers on their staff and to give them the time to nurture them and the resources, where possible, to support them? And above all, I really think we underestimate the importance of teacher engagement in the school. You know, the extra time that teachers will put in to after-school activities as well as within lesson activities if they're really passionately engaged and committed to the school.
You've written a lot in this field around professional learning communities and the idea of the research engaged school. So I know it's difficult to look across the whole system, but you know, how would you evaluate where we're at the moment, Clive? You know, you've written about you know, the idea that the school should be the locus of educational research, and that possibly even formal roles should be created, you know, either within a school or in links with universities, and that teachers should be you know, receiving some form or seeking some form of training or education and research skills. So, you know, where has that been done well, either within Scotland or internationally?
Well, internationally, I suppose, systems like Singapore, where I have had the privilege of working, have been leading the way in the sense that the Singapore government has obliged, really, every school in Singapore to be a professional learning community, and for every teacher to be engaged in researching their and their colleagues' practices. And so That probably is one of the leading systems at the moment in terms of research engagement of teachers across the system. I think there's many promising developments in Scotland at the moment, and the future is really bright if we can create more system leaders, more school improvement partnerships, more school collaborative arrangements, and to bring in research support institutions such as universities, where my idea is that research, asking teachers to research, to undertake serious research, is a big call when we all know how busy they are and how overworked they are. But instead of researchers in universities operating in isolated units, I'd love to see us university researchers going into schools, working alongside teachers, and making the schools the centres of the research agenda. And then teachers could more easily pick up the research skills from the university academics researchers. And you've got the combination of very powerful forces at work between the university and the schools in those instances, and between groups of schools. And it's by such means that the standards of teaching can be raised through in inquiry and research-focused practice.
So you talk about the importance of data as well, and
research becomes focused around the problems of individual schools, not agendas forged in remote university departments of education. So the data from particular schools would indicate, for example, where the areas of improvement of those schools are or where they lie. And given the school community's agreement to do something about those areas that need improvement, as shown by the data, by the evidence, then the research agenda could be built around those school improvement needs. And those would differ, obviously, from school to school and locality to locality. I mean, the Highlands and Islands of Scotland would be very different problems and issues, maybe, from the centre of Glasgow or Edinburgh.
But you say throughout, don't you, Clive, that the tacit knowledge is also important. So is there a hierarchy? Is it less important, or does it feature in other kinds of conversations within a working week or within the school? Is it something that has its place within a professional learning community? Where exactly is the tacit knowledge valued?
It's a very good question. In my opinion, in practice, it's overvalued at the moment. That is to say, there's not enough, probably in most schools, there is not enough awareness and interest in academic research knowledge. And an over-reliance on what you've rightly called tacit knowledge, which is knowledge from experience. I do it this way because this is what I've found over 5, 10, 15 years of experience works for me. Now, when we put those two together, the academic research knowledge and the tacit knowledge, which I would hope we would do in more in the future, then I think it's sort of like 50. I'd love to see a 50-50 balance. But that is to say, I don't want us to put too much store on academic knowledge, neither do I want us to put too much store on tacit knowledge. But both together make a very compelling, powerful combination. So in other words, teachers and principals and leaders in schools need much greater awareness and cognizance of the research evidence that university and literature, academic literature, provides, both UK-based and internationally. But at the end of the day, it's really important that every set of leaders and their colleagues understand it and understand the academic literature and have a chance to balance it against their own experience of tacit knowledge. And it's that powerful combination of mediating the academic knowledge, making sense of it, and accepting and rejecting bits and pieces of it that, that colleagues feel in their own school communities make sense to them, and they feel they can own, and they feel they can implement. Because at the end of the day, it's all about what is implemented successfully. You can have good, powerful ideas, but if they can't be implemented successfully, they count for very little. So that's why I put equal emphasis on tacit knowledge. We must never discard the importance of experienced knowledge.
And just finally, Clive, going back to, I suppose, the kind of core theme of your work, you know, this idea about high-performing leaders breaking the mould of mediocre leadership, as you put it, and these high-performing principles or leaders possess different qualities. You know, how are we in Scotland doing in terms of creating more of these high-performing leaders, and where might we need to learn better from other international colleagues?
Well, I think the answer to that is we're probably being honest at the beginnings of the process. If I just refer to the Skill Fellowship Programme, which is actually very much focused on creating and generating system leaders, that's been going for two intakes now, two-year annual intakes. So judged against the course of time, we're in Scotland, we're probably towards the beginning of the process, but each year that goes past, of course, the idea is that Skill Fellows graduate and in turn have create cadres across the system, and hopefully with a view to multiplying the effects of good system leadership. So I'm sure we can expect a sort of a mushrooming effect of good system, high-performing leaders as time goes by. I think, too, the formation of an organization like Scale gives an international profile to school leadership in Scotland, and that's all to the good, too, because it means to say that Scottish principals and leaders have access to international conferences. We had a big international congress of school effectiveness in Glasgow in January. And it allows Scottish leaders much higher profile and access to the latest ideas internationally regarding school leadership. So I'm very optimistic and very passionate and enthusiastic that I think, you know, the future is looking really good. That's not to say that we don't already have some very powerful leaders, school leaders in Scotland, but we need for sure a lot more, and we need to generate more high-performing leaders, as I've argued, across the entire system.
Clive, thank you so much for joining us in EduTalk this evening. I wonder if you could just leave us with maybe a couple of sort of key writers on systems leadership, or where we can find out more about your own work in this area, or the work of the Robert Owen Centre.
Yes, for sure. Well, I wrote a book in 2012 called Leadership, Capacity and School Capacity Building and School Improvement, published by Routledge. And a lot of the ideas any of your listeners interested will find some interest in that book. David Hopkins is a name from south of the border who's written quite a bit about system leadership. So I think, you know, if your listeners want to particularly follow up on system leadership, David Hopkins is as good a reference as any.
Clive, thanks again, and best wishes with your work in the future.
Thank you, David. It's been very enjoyable. Thanks for giving me the time.